Hey, everybody. This is Jack.
And this is Nick.
And this is Build Phase. So you work in Thoughtbot's London office, and you worked there before it was Thoughtbot, right?
I did, yes. I started a few months before we became Thoughtbot. I had the interesting experience of sitting down on my first day and then having Laurie, the development director now of the London office, go, mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, we're becoming Thoughtbot, which was one of the most interesting ways, perhaps, you could have started the first sure. day and your first hour on a job that you don't quite know what it's going to be like.
But I assume you were familiar with Thoughtbot before that.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Presumably. I'd previously run a startup that had done a mix of Rails and iOS stuff, and we'd use loads of Thoughtbot things, Factory sure. Girl, for example.
Yeah, that's cool. So how are things going over there? I haven't really been in touch with you in a while, and or with anybody in that office much. Is everything rolling along nicely?
Yeah, things are going well at the moment. We've got some interesting good. Products. We continue to be kind of quiet, but we keep ourselves busy.
Quiet relative to the rest of Thoughtbot, is that what you mean? Or
yes.
Less chatter in Slack?
Yes, apart from perhaps myself.
Okay. Well, that was one of the things that I know that being at Thoughtbot here in Stockholm, it was nice when London came aboard because suddenly we had more people who were awake and online during the day with us, even though you guys were all quieter than Stockholm, even though you were way yeah. more than us, but it was good to have you around. Cool. So you have any interesting projects you've been working on lately or any interesting technologies you've been touching?
I've just finished working on a combination iOS and Rails project that was difficult. It's definitely a case of someone misunderstanding the concept of what an MVP is, which is one of my big bugbears, really. People build too much pretty consistently, and they'll often build stuff badly. And that makes for an interesting client project.
So you feel like the misunderstanding was with the client or with some previous developers they had or the mix?
Sometimes a mix. I think technology is difficult, and it's incredibly difficult to be starting something when you're not a programmer yourself.
Right.
And you're in a pretty bad position when you start that way. Definitely makes you feel for the people who are trying to do that. I often come across horror stories of people who have worked with some distant CTO who either disappears one morning and never comes back, and right. they end up with nothing which is useful at all. And that's not great. And I think it's quite easy for developers to say yes all the time and not go, oh, maybe we shouldn't do this. Maybe there's a simpler way to build what you're doing, which requires a lot less effort.
Yeah, I think that is really important, is to be able to, as a developer or designer, to be able to push back against the client, not to tell the client that they are wrong exactly. Well, yeah, to tell them that, be able to tell them that they're wrong, like not that they're entirely wrong, but that they need to sort of think about the scope of what they're doing, think about how to focus on what's important and not get bogged down in either unnecessary detail or get bogged down in trying to do too much all at once.
Yeah, I think founders are an interesting group of people. They have wide aims for what they're trying to do, and a lot of enthusiasm, and it's infectious. And sometimes to stretch this analogy too far, we can become infected by that enthusiasm. We want to build all the things. And that's something I see pretty consistently. Everyone wants to build as much as possible in a short period of time. And that often doesn't go very well.
Yeah, I think there's a notion that many people starting companies have of saying that, okay, they have a vision of what they think the complete product is going to be. And they don't want to release anything less than that. Like they want to say, okay, we want to work until this thing that I have in my mind has crystallized in actual application, and then we'll release it in the world, and then the gods will smile upon us and I will be wealthy.
And the problem
is that they don't get to test their assumptions. They don't get to find out along the way if this is the right thing they're doing. It's sort of, I feel like there ought to be some boot camp for people starting this sort of tech companies where they actually learn about iterative software development and the approach that we take and why it's useful. That it's not just like we're not doing it because we like it, because we think this is a more fun way to develop software. we do it because it makes sense.
Yes.
For a lot of reasons. And I think that just like you are saying, I've encountered lots of people who don't seem to get this because they haven't done it before. You know, people who are, they're starting their first company or one of their first companies, and they have this grand idea, and they've got maybe some funding, and they have, you know, it might be a really great idea, and they can be very impatient and unwilling to take baby steps to find their way forward and find how do we actually build what we're trying to build and make sure that it's the right thing and the useful thing. Does that correspond with what you've seen as well?
Yeah, for sure. It's definitely a case of too much and too much of the future goal and not the present reality. There's always the adage of as soon as you put an application in front of a bunch of users, they're going to use it in a completely different way to which you imagined anyway.
Right.
And it's very difficult to point that out, that's what's going to happen.
Mm. You mentioned this, and it does come up again and again that people have this experience. And I think from our standpoint, it tends to be that, you know, okay, here we go. We have this customer, this person, this company, whatever it is, who has what to us seem like unrealistic expectations that, you know, we know they can't have all of this done in the time they want or with the budget they have. We want to try and guide them. And it can be very hard because, like you said, it can also be somewhat infectious. If someone is super, you know, super gung-ho, super excited about what they're building, it's easy to get sucked along with that. You know, go along for the ride and say, yeah, sure, we've got an awesome team here. I bet we can do this. Why not? And each thing you commit to might have, you know, 1,000 more details that you didn't think about when you committed to it. And suddenly, a month in, you're like, oh, wow, okay, now I see. we've only scratched the surface of this, and we're supposed to be done in 2 months from now. And just it's tricky.
It is. Definitely suffered from the curse of continuing week by week by week by week, and we extend week by week by week, and we keep going, okay, we'll do a few more things, we'll fix a few more bugs, or we'll implement more features, and we'll keep going and going and going, and the time to do it is when it's super uncomfortable to be releasing that into the world, but with a product that works well and does solve that core problem.
So you're saying you recently finished such a project that was a bit tricky?
Yes, I'm now on something different, and I've been building a hypermedia API, which is the first time I've done this. It's super interesting to be working on something which tests itself, which is the approach I've been taking.
So you need to explain to maybe listeners, and for sure me, what you mean by developing a hypermedia API.
You're right. So if we think of the concept of REST, RESTful APIs, so we're following approximately the HTTP standard, get, post, put, patch, etc., all of whom fit certain actions. So get gets you data, put updates some data in place, post creates new data. Where hypermedia comes in is we start talking about links. Links are the thing that make the web work the way it does. So the hypermedia in this is the same as a web page. So one page links to another page, and another page links to another page. And the goal that you're trying to do with building a hypermedia API is to have an application that works exactly the same way as a web page does. You go to the home page, or in this case, the root of the API, and then you know where else you can get within that. So imagining a hypothetical company's website has an about page and has some listing about their products, and we can go to the root of our API, and we can find where the about page is, and we can find where the product page is, and we can find each of the individual products from those, and we can then wander our way around the API, and we don't need to know anything about the endpoints that are there, because the API tells us, it describes itself.
Okay, so is this, because I remember reading Roy Fielding wrote about REST and this idea of that he was kind of saying at some point, well, a lot of people are missing the point. The point is that she will fetch a document that describes what more can be done relative to that in the form of, I think he was talking about, like, you would put relative links in the head section so that you would know that, okay, this is an HTML page, and here we declare some actions that can lead you to other things you can fetch or things you can edit, you know, that you can post or put or whatever. Is that what we're looking at here?
Absolutely. That's definitely it.
That's cool, because I was actually just talking about this with some people at the client that I'm on, because they were talking about various, like, I started complaining because someone pointed me at the documentation for a third party web service that this client is using that was allegedly a REST web service, where everything was a post. That was it. There were no gets. Everything was a post. And then, so like, if you're actually getting something, you would be posting something to a URL, you know, some resource / identifier / get. Like, there would be a get in the URL instead of that you were changing something. So I started complaining about this, and we started talking about this whole thing. I like what you're talking about, and I mentioned this, that, you know, the ideal would be if you had things that were sort of documents that had contained metadata about what related actions could be performed on them. You could make a generic application that could fetch such a thing and have a default mechanism for rendering something. So say if the content of the page is mostly textual, it could just show text. If there's something that seems to be structured in some way, it could form it in a table. And if it is a particular kind of resource that the application knows about and is built for, then can have a particular view for that. So you could have an application that, okay, we're dealing with banking and we've got transactions and users and accounts and we know how to render those things. But if later at some point the backend adds some other new types of data that our application doesn't have specific views for, it can actually still render them in at least a simplistic way, let a user view it in some sense. Just the same way you can add stuff to a web page and a human can look at it even if they've never seen it before.
Yeah, that's kind of exactly what we're trying to aim for. There's some practical concerns to that. Something I've seen a lot in Swift is, because of the type safety, we can't just add more elements, or we can't adjust existing elements to be a bit more correct. But we can add more and they'll just get ignored. And that's perfectly fine, but adjusting is a problem there.
Mm. So the back end is Rails and front end is iOS, essentially? Is that?
No, not in this project. No, so okay. I end up doing a mix of Ruby stuff and also iOS stuff. My previous project was both, which was interesting. I had the fun experience of command tabbing between Xcode and Vim.
Sure.
Constantly through the same day, which is always interesting. Now I'm just doing a Ruby thing.
Okay.
Which is quite nice in some respects. Less to keep in my mind at least, and that helps.
Yeah, a little more focus.
Yeah.
But the front end is iOS that someone else is building, or is it a different kind of front end?
It's another application. So I'm basically building a service that wraps a data dump that we get from an FTP bucket, which is interesting.
Okay. Hmm.
Because it turns out that FTP is still used in the real world.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah, a lot.
Yeah.
I have a friend who, he doesn't anymore, but he worked for a long time for a company that dealt in fuel prices in the US, basically for trucking, for transportation companies, so they could plot out their journeys for their drivers driving across the country. Where is the best place to refuel?
Yep.
And, you know, he was describing huge swaths of what they used to do. And this was a while ago, but I wouldn't be surprised if it's still the same. Huge amounts of what they would do was FTP based. Like, the things that I would think of as, okay, we want to have some sort of triggers service that is triggered by doing something. It's like, no. It was FTP, like, just like, you know, generating some data in some sort of format and FTPing it somewhere, and then a batch job somewhere else picks that up and does something with it. It's pretty amazing.
It makes me realize that there must be so many systems that exist in this same way. How else? It's lots of legacy things which can't talk to each other for various interesting reasons have now a solution to this, which is dumping the data from some legacy database and then wrapping it in some other service. So then another application can actually read that data back in again.
And then later spit it back out and FTP it somewhere else.
Right, absolutely.
And at some point, if the system you're building right now is very successful, in 20 years, someone will look at this and say, have you seen this thing? Why do we have to use this crazy old thing? And not only is this thing crazy and old, behind it all, it's fetching something with FTP. Like, sometimes it's like we're building on like more nodes in this network of weird things that that exists out there in the world. And you never know which of these things are going to sparkle and then fade away, and which things are going to become permanent. Because, you know, because somebody's $1 million a day business depends on this thing that somebody wrote somewhere, and that, you know, and can almost never be changed.
Yeah. And when do we know whether or not we did the right thing? Did we pick the right technology? Did we pick the right approach? We don't know. We're only going to
know
20 years time when we realize that, yes, we did that badly and that was not a good idea.
Yep.
Programming, eh? Isn't it great fun?
That's what we do. I've been having a good time lately. I'm working on a client which has, it's an iOS app. It's been around for a few years, and they started off in Objective-C and building it with Reactive Cocoa, which is great. And yep. So now more and more of the app is in Swift, and therefore also Reactive Swift. And it's good. Like, the team is really good at sort of keeping on top of, you know, being close to the latest versions of the whole Reactive Swift set of things now, which is actually that. So now there's Reactive Swift. There's the Swift part. Reactive Objective-C is the Objective-C part. Reactive Cocoa is just sort of the linkages to UIKit and to AppKit on the Mac, I guess. And yep. Then there's, I think it's something called, I think it's the Reactive Bridge or Reactive Objective-C Bridge. I forget. That sort of kind of links together. So you can kind of make a signal in one and then transfer it into the other kind of signal.
Oh, that's nice.
So in the old, what used to be called Reactive Cocoa, what's now Reactive Objective-C, everything starts with the RAC prefix. You can create a RAC signal.
Yes.
Whereas in Reactive Swift, it's all, the prefixes are gone, and it's a different set of classes that are implemented in Swift instead. But you can actually take a RAC signal and convert it to just a signal in the Swift version. So this application has many layers because it's been built over the span of many years, or say, you know, 3 years, maybe 3-4 years. Not a super long time, but a while. Mm-hmm. And a number of developers. So it's interesting. Like, almost every new feature we're going to add ends up being a bit of an archaeological exploration, because we have to figure out, okay, so the view controller that controls this section, okay, this part is in Swift. Oh, but it's dealing with, some of its table view cells are Objective-C, and they've got a view model that is using Objective-C Reactive Cocoa instead of, you know, so it's sort of, it's a lot of digging and twiddling, but it's pretty fun.
Huh, interesting. That's a lot of things to keep in your mind at one go.
Right. And it's the thing where not only is there the choice when you're implementing something to say, okay, I can either choose, say I've got a label, and the label's being populated with some data from some model object that I have.
Yep.
Beyond just the choice of, okay, should this string value be mediated through a view model instead of the view controller talking to a model directly, but also, should that view model be updating itself through a signal from some other data source? And also, should that signal be a RAC signal from the Objective-C side,
yeah,
or a signal from the Swift side? It all depends on sort of where it's coming from. And like, we're trying as we go to move everything towards the Swift way of doing things. But sometimes there are things that, okay, this whole big piece is all Objective-C, and it doesn't make sense to try and rewrite this or refactor a huge chunk of this into Swift right now. Today, I just have, you know, I've got to add one little thing. And so it ends up, we end up kind of tacking stuff into lower levels that is the Objective-C stuff that we're trying not to deal with, but we have to. But it's fun. So that's what I'm doing for a while. And this is, for me, definitely the biggest Reactive Cocoa, Reactive Swift project that I've been involved in. I've kind of been following Reactive Cocoa for years, actually. I think I know I gave a talk about it at a Cocoa Heads meeting in Stockholm, and I think that was like in 2012 or something, like a long time ago. Like, I played with it a little bit, and I was like, wow, this is really cool. And I've used it sparingly in apps since then. Now and then, like, I've never built any entire apps around Reactive Swift, React Cocoa. I kind of sprinkled it in certain places where it seemed to fit and be helpful.
What are those scenarios? Where do you feel like it fits in really well?
One of the places that I found it especially good for, and this is kind of before we had Swift even, I've always liked KVO. At least, I mean, I'm not that fond of the API in a sense, but the functionality that we can say, okay, any object, any property that is visible on some object we can get observations about changes. It's a great way to sort of shuffle data around different parts of your application without having to, you don't have to purposely send a notification saying, I'm changing this thing. Anybody can just observe things.
Yep.
But KVO, the API, is a little bit funky to use. And it's not always clear. Like, you don't want to have, in an iOS app, view controllers that know about each other, right?
Right.
So the typical thing is you might have some global object that ends up being kind of a dumping ground for stuff. And that's pretty common. You know, it used to be that often it would be the app delegate, right? It would end up being this terrible dumping ground.
Oh, absolutely.
Which, I mean, I'm sure some people still do. But what I ended up doing in a few applications was, where I found a need for this, what I would do is I would use a global object of some kind as kind of a model of the application's current state. I remember there's an application that had kind of this hamburger menu that would pop in from the left, right? And the state, what that menu would show would be different depending on what main view you were currently looking at. So you might have up one of 2, 3, 4 different main views. And when that hamburger menu swipes in, it's not going to be the same content every time. It's going to be some different stuff based on what you're currently looking at, what your selection is. And so rather than having that menu, like, observe some, like, try and keep track of, okay, what view controller am I looking at right now when I'm coming in? Instead, as the user navigated through the application, I had what essentially amounted to sort of an enum that had a value that was maintained by this central object. So whenever one of these view controllers that was indicative of the application's current GUI state came to the forefront, it would set this property and say, okay, now you're looking at the main content page, or the user is, or, you know, say now the user is looking at the settings page, or the user is looking at whatever it was. And it would do that by just setting a property on this global object. It was a singleton of some kind.
Yep.
And then the menu could observe that same property. So that as soon as the user navigated somewhere, that menu would immediately get a notification. There was no notification sent. It was just an observation through KVO. And that's all fine, except that KVO is just kind of ugly to use in a lot of ways. And so just by a little tweak of wrapping that in Reactive Cocoa, it became quite easy to observe the state of the application. I think there were a couple more things I did in one app. So the only real use of Reactive Cocoa was kind of just that. Like, I had this global object that was kind of the current application view state that any view could sort of poke in and say, okay, I'm now doing this, and meaning the user is now looking at this. And anybody who needed to know could observe that. And so you could have that menu could change, or like the title bar could change. So that was another thing. You could have like a title bar that was kind of independent of the content view. So when the content view was changed, we didn't have to say, okay, now I know that when this content view changes, I have to go and tweak the title bar also. Rather, it was a separate entity of its own that would just observe the application state and say, oh, now it's this, so I'll change this, enable this button, or hide this thing, or whatever. So that sort of thing I found Reactive Cocoa pretty useful for. So I've done a few things like that, and I've done some other reactive things. I've done did some C# reactive stuff not that long ago, but the project I'm on now is the first time that I've actually worked on a large-scale iOS application that's really built around this heavily. And I like it, and I'm still sometimes quite befuddled by it. Like, it's hard to sometimes it's hard to figure out what I want to do. Or I know what I want to do, but it's hard to figure out exactly how to do it always, because there's so much indirection.
Right.
Things become less that. It's, you know, it's not imperative programming. It's not do this, then this, then this. It's more, okay, I'm setting up this thing, and then inside of there is a block that's gonna be called when the thing is done. It can make debugging a bit tricky, and it can just make writing the code a bit tricky, because everything you're writing is always stuff that's waiting for something else to happen sometime.
Yeah. How do you find that for testing? Is that a lot of complexity, or is that not that bad because you find that each of these components are isolated?
It's actually not that bad. So a lot of the Reactive Cocoa and Swift stuff that we have going on there is in the view model layer. So we're able to test the view models using Inspecta and these other things.
Yep.
And the Swift, Quick.
Yes.
Nimble. So we have kind of all of these things. We're hitting all of these buttons. So we're able to use those quite a bit to test the view model layer. And all of these have functionality for sort of kicking something off. And then the thing you're expecting to happen is a keyword to say, you know, wait, or, you know, there's like a way you can sort of say, okay, I don't expect this value to be what I'm looking for right now, but within a certain timeout. So it can start something and the application can run a little bit to let all these things sort of trickle down. So the value you're trying to poke in somewhere actually produces a result somewhere.
Right. I see. Yeah, that makes sense.
So it's not too bad. The application is large enough that I found it at first a bit overwhelming when I started diving into it and trying to figure things out, because the people who have been working there for a while, you know, they're used to it, especially one of the main developers who's been there for a few years working on this almost all the time. It's the kind of thing that if you're there from the beginning and building it up, it all kind of makes sense. And you know, like any big system, you know, oh, right, that thing is like that because Joe built that part 3 years ago and then we tied it into that. And sort of like, you know, it becomes a sort of not monstrosity, but a thing that is complex because it is complex and has many layers and has history and has time. So like, I guess like any large project, but I think the fact that there's all the reactive stuff made it for me a bit trickier to dive into and start to feel productive on, but it's going pretty well now.
That's super interesting.
Have you done any reactive Cocoa stuff at all?
I've not, no. I've not come across it. Well, I have come across it.
Right.
I've not used it, is what I mean.
Right.
Eventually, hopefully I might. Everything I've done with iOS over the last few years, I've done quite a lot less of it than I would like. And so it's usually been pretty vanilla iOS work.
Sure.
And simple. And that's quite nice. It's nice to jump back into it again. This recent project that I was on was the first one when I'd worked with Swift 3. I'd done a very early Swift project. So it was like effectively the second project that I'd done in Swift. Like such a big gap between things. It is really fascinating to come back to something which has changed so much and evolved in such a big way.
Right.
And to see that there are now such nicer patterns for doing the same thing that I would have done before.
Right. So is because the earlier project that you're talking about, that's the one you were working on with Kale a year ago or so.
Yeah, that's
right?
It, yeah.
Right. Yeah, so yeah, I'm just thinking about how much has changed since then. It is like you're saying, there's so much that happens. And the thing that I've noticed especially is that I think about something like Argo, which, you know, was created at Thoughtbot. And the project I'm on right now, by the way, is using Argo. It's still very much a valid thing, right? It's out there in the world. And yet so much of what Argo was built to take care of for you, like Swift has kind of evolved to take care of a lot of those things. Like one of the main things back in the early day was the sort of pyramid of doom where you would have these sort of stacked or nested if lets to check to see that all your values are set, right? And so it took care of that eventually. But Argo took care of that years ago before Swift had a good way of doing it.
Right, absolutely.
It's interesting how many things are that Swift is really evolving to cover a lot of use cases. You know, it's not, I do not believe that it is evolving intentionally to eliminate Argo, but I believe that, you know, it's evolving to do things that people need to do. Have you seen, there was maybe a month ago, there was some kind of proposal sent around about serialization. Have you seen this?
I've not seen this, no.
Okay, I can talk about it a little bit. I'll find a link post in the show notes. It was a really interesting idea for serialization for Swift that reminded me a bit of things like NS archiving,
right?
That has been around in Cocoa forever. But the idea being that it was sort of extensible and you could kind of define your own underlying archive formats and that sort of thing. So you could take any sort of object that implemented the right protocols could be archived into some general intermediate format in a way, just in memory. And then you could have your own underlying definition of how that format is actually saved to disk. So it could be JSON, but it could be XML, or it could be CSV, or it could be, you know, piped into a web service that uploads it via FTP. Who knows?
Everything is possible. Everything could be horrifyingly complicated.
Yeah, so, but it was interesting, and it kind of addressed the fact that Swift has, or the Swift community has a glut of options when it comes to serializing data, when it comes to unpacking JSON and all these things.
Yep.
You know, I think it would be good to have something that is kind of Apple-blessed in a way, or at least Swift team-blessed, something that could be integrated nicely, and is yet open enough that anybody can sort of work with it and extend it. It's relatively easy to make your own classes and structs and enums and everything archivable, and also define how you want that archiving to actually happen at the nuts and bolts level. So I will, I'll find a link. Well, I'll attach to the show notes. I don't even have a title. It was something like Serialization in Swift. I don't remember. It was pretty cool, though.
Yeah, it does sound really interesting.
And I don't know. I read it when it came out. I haven't looked to see this current status. I don't know if it's, you know, it's in the Swift Evolution system there. I don't know if it's on track, if it's still being discussed, if it's been dismissed out of hand. Who knows? But I thought it was interesting. All right. Well, hey, I wonder if we should wrap this up today.
Yeah, that sounds like a good idea.
All right. You can find show notes for this episode at buildphase.fm/118, episode 118. You can reach us by email. Send it to hosts@buildphase.fm. And you can find us on Twitter @buildphase. And of course, we appreciate all of your comments and reviews on iTunes or anywhere else you may find this podcast. Please go in and give us all the stars. All right, Nick, thanks.
Jack, thank you.
All right, talk to you soon.
Talk to you soon.